Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you today. Great as always to have your company. Coming up today, one of the biggest names in the motor industry, Carlos Tavares, is gone as the boss of Stellantis. We try to figure out why.
If you start to cut cost on investment in new product, then you're basically heading toward a death spiral.
We'll also take a look at what it means now for the owner of the likes of Fiat, Chrysler, Peugeot, Dodge and Jeep. Also today, it's election week in Ghana. We report on the ups and downs of Ghana's economy.
It is huge and it's growing on a yearly basis, yes. Currently, we can't even meet demand.
Yes, and China thinks it's found the world's largest gold deposit worth potentially more than $60 billion in value. Stories from Asia, Africa, Europe, here on the programme today, where we are your place for everything you need to know about global business and the world economy. And we always love to hear your views on what's going on too. And you can do so by getting in touch with us on our WhatsApp number, which is plus 44 for the UK, 330-678-3033. So that's plus 44, 330-678-3033. Let's start here in Europe, though. If tomorrow the government collapses over the budget, there will immediately be a financial crisis. So warned the French Interior Minister Bruno Retailleau at the weekend. Well, that looks a step closer now, potentially, because in the last few hours, the French Prime Minister Michel Barnier used a quirk of the French Constitution to push through budget plans. The move, almost certain to trigger a vote of no confidence as a result in the minority government of the party of President Emmanuel Macron. It seems the Prime Minister took the gamble after this warning from Jordan Bardella, the party chief of France's Rassemblement National party, on the French broadcaster RTL on Monday morning.
Once Michel Barnier pursues the policies of Emmanuel Macron, of course, the National Rally will vote no confidence in the government. Yes, the National Rally will use the mechanism of a no-confidence vote. Unless, of course, there is a last-minute miracle, if Michel Barnier were to redo his homework before 3 p.m., but I don't have much hope for a miracle, given that we have been knowingly ignored and disdained for several months.
Thomas Michalski is Associate Professor for Economics at the HEC Business School. He joins us live from Paris now. Thomas, thanks for being so with us here on World Business Report. First of all, been a lot of wrangling over everything in this budget, everything from the price of electricity potentially being hiked to potentially other changes as well around reforms to medical provisions and things like that as well. Just give us a sense, if you can, as to what have been the big issues here.
So it turned out when Barnier came to power that this year's budget situation of France was particularly dire, which was a little bit of a surprise. This came about a bit after there was a huge increase in especially health expenditures and related. The new government had a hard task of improving the budget and lowering the deficit that would still be quite humongous by any standards to 5% of GDP. What they did, the bureaucrats cut all across the board in different types of expenditures, tries to raise some taxes, as you mentioned, the electricity tax. They tried to lower the indexation for inflation for pensions, for example, tried to lower the generous medical cost reimbursements and so on and so forth. All among others, and all the three that I just mentioned are, of course, very unpopular, especially with the right-wing electorate that Marine Le Pen is trying to represent as well.
Yeah, and just Thomas, try to explain as well, beyond France's borders, there's a lot of concern, and we'll talk to Rachel Winter, our markets guest, in a moment about exactly this as well, but a lot of concern that this could have ramifications for the entire European economy. Just explain why a domestic row about things like energy prices and stuff like that is potentially got ramifications like that.
Of course. So the first thing is that it doesn't seem that given that There's a political stalemate in France, and there's a huge deficit, and French funding costs are increasing. The second largest European economy is providing to be very unstable, with the fact that Germany is continuing a economic malaise that doesn't bode well for the entire European economy. It also means, given the political instability and possibly that the government is going to fail, no further reforms. The old ones are endangered. For example, the pension reform in France is not was not maybe abrogated, maybe simply called off. And this means that there's going to be a problem at the European level, because France wanted to be a startup hub. They had some success trying to become the financial capital of EU. And if that doesn't happen, the entire year is going to have reverberations of this.
Yeah. And Rachel is having reverberations. Rachel Winter of Killick & Co. here in the UK, having reverberations, isn't it, already on the markets, not just the stock market, but also the cost of French government borrowing as well.
Yeah, exactly. So France does have a lot of debt. France's debt is worth about 112% of its GDP. That's very high. If we compare that to Germany, Germany's debt is only worth about 63% of its GDP. So what we've seen this week is people selling French bonds and moving into German bonds because they've seen them as being safer.
Really interesting. Plenty more from Rachel throughout the programme. And thanks to Thomas Michalski of HEC Business School in Paris there on that breaking news. Sure, it's something we're going to keep going back to on the World Service throughout the day. Remaining in Europe, more issues for some of the biggest players in the global car industry. In a moment, we'll hear about thousands of workers at Volkswagen heading out on strike in Germany. But first, just what is going on at one of the world's largest groups of automakers, Stellantis? Late Sunday night, European time, the boss, Carlos Tavares, announced he was off after a clear split on the board about what the company does to try and respond to the pressure traditional automakers are under in that shift to electric vehicles. David Bailey, Professor of Business Economics at Birmingham Business School in the UK, gave us a sense of the challenges the company faced.
Huge turmoil in the car industry generally in terms of the big downturn in China. EV sales are slowing, Chinese brands penetrating Western markets, and there's a cost of the transition to electric vehicles. But on top of all of that, Stellantis have got particular problems of declining sales, declining profits, revenue down, operating margins being hit. And what's really, really driving that, I think, is the situation in North America, where they've had appalling results, very dated product lineup, rising inventories and slipping market share, as a result of which all the stakeholders involved, suppliers, dealers, workers, investors, are deeply unhappy. I think that has penetrated the board and made his position untenable.
Well, Bill Russo was a longtime senior exec for one part of what is now Stellantis as the head of Northeast Asia operations for the American car brand Chrysler. Bill's now the founder and CEO of the advisory firm Automobility, based in Shanghai in China. And I asked him where he thought Carlos Tavares might have gone wrong.
Tavares sought to make the company, I'd say, shrink its market and make it more of a premium car maker. And that's very difficult to do without redefining what the brands represent. And the stakeholders really reacted negatively to his approach.
And this idea that a lot of the models were slightly out of date, too, that they hadn't perhaps given enough TLC to that.
If you start to cut cost on investment in new product, then you're basically heading toward a death spiral. You've got to invest in new products constantly to keep consumers interested in your brand. They were cutting products and trying to raise prices at the same time for whatever was left. Retreat to profitability is kind of what they were trying to do, is trading off quantity of sales for quality of sales, but that's hard to do when you've got dealers who profit from volume. So, you know, when you have so many stakeholders all looking at this company and saying, hey, you're making it smaller, you're making it harder for us to see a future for ourselves.
The point in all these big alliances, Bill, like Stellantis, these big sort of groupings of brands that we'd all have heard of, was about economies of scale. That as these things got more expensive to do, if you had more brands, bigger was kind of better. But are we actually seeing the flip of that now, the difficulty that that can cause, Stellantis being pointed out, and perhaps the difficulties that some of its individual brands have had from not having that attention that you were talking about, and also seeing it in other alliances as well, the trouble that Nissan, for example, too. Mm. Does it raise questions about these, I guess, the limitations of these economy of scale alliances?
Well, economy of scale, the basic idea is you get bigger and therefore you drive down your unit cost. The idea of scale means you grow to a larger and more efficient business through the combination, and that failed to happen here. You have a very misaligned set of brands and market where these brands are represented. And the thing that we haven't talked about, which I think is important, is this industry is going through a massive restructuring right now, where the U.S. and European markets, they haven't been growth markets for a long time, but they're in a recessionary period in terms of market size. And the big growth opportunity isn't what had been in China, and it isn't anymore for these products, and in particular for this company. One of the things Tavares tried to do was form a venture, an investment in a Chinese EV maker to try to reposition the company for forward growth. But it's too early in that process to even know if that's going to be an effective long-term strategy for them.
All those challenges are now going to fall to the new man or woman. And it comes on a day that we're seeing big protests by workers from Volkswagen, another one of those companies that you were talking about that have struggled with that transition. I mean, is there a way back into the Chinese market in particular, but into those Asian markets where the companies you watch so closely now are dominating? And if not, what is the direction for those North American and European brands?
I'd like to say that anything's possible, but from what I've seen over the last 4 years in China is a market that's flipped completely upside down. Chinese consumers have moved on to regarding Chinese brands, particularly the EVs and the intelligent connected vehicles that are being built by Chinese companies, as state-of-the-art technology. Foreign brands are in a without the Chinese market, they lack the scale and they lack the competitiveness on the next generation of automotive technology. And that hurts every single multinational company.
That's Bill Russo there, the chief exec of Automobility and a former Chrysler exec now based in Shanghai in China. Not just Stellantis, though, of course, under pressure. Workers at the German carmaker Volkswagen are out on strike today at VW's plants right across Germany. They're being described as warning strikes, which typically last a few hours. The BBC's Damian McGuinness in Berlin explained more.
The company says in order to ensure the company's financial security in the future, there has to be a 10% wage cut rather than wage rises, and mass redundancies are threatened. Maybe tens of thousands of jobs could go, according to some documents. And they're even suggesting plant closures in Germany, which would be the first time that such a thing has been even suggested in the company's almost 90-year history.
Damian McGuinness there in Berlin, or Rachel Winter from Killick & Co. here in London still with us. And Rachel, that's having a big impact on European shares, full stop, isn't it? And speaks to some of the pressure that not just these two companies we've talked about, but the kind of those legacy car brands that Bill Russo was talking about are under stock market wise at the moment.
Yeah, they are. So over the last year, shares in Volkswagen in particular are down about 30%. So very negative performance there. They're actually up a tiny bit today. And I think that's because this strike was very much largely expected. But nevertheless, it is very difficult to see what the future is going to be for these companies, because governments around the world have given all these companies very strict targets in relation to switching to electric vehicles. But consumers around the world haven't been given much incentive or much support to buy these electric vehicles. So we're seeing a real mismatch between supply and demand, and that's a problem for these companies profitability-wise.
Rachel, thanks so much as always for your time. Rachel Winter there from the UK investment platform Killick & Co. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Now, Bangladesh wants to sharply lower prices under a power purchase deal with India's embattled Adani Group. It comes as its boss, Gautam Adani, spoke for the first time at the weekend since indictments in the US over his business dealings. Arundhati Mukherjee, our senior India business reporter, came to that. But first of all, he addressed the issues between Bangladesh and the Adani Group.
Well, essentially, Will, what's happened is that the interim government in Bangladesh has expressed a desire that they would be keen on looking at renegotiating aspects of a power agreement that was stitched in 2017 when the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who was very friendly towards India, was in power before she was ousted earlier this year. Now, the minister was quoted while speaking to the Reuters news agency in an interview, and this is the de facto power minister, who said that Bangladesh was not benefiting from certain Indian tax exemptions that the power plant in eastern India, which supplies electricity to Bangladesh, was getting. Essentially, they were saying that the tax benefits are not cascading down, benefiting Bangladesh and its citizens. Now, the Adani Group, on their part, has not responded, but it's said that in the past that power supply that they are giving aims to significantly reduce the cost for the end consumer. So this is essentially where the conflict lies, and Bangladesh's interim government is already probing this particular agreement, as well as six other power contracts with the Adani Group. But essentially, this means that, you know, Adani's business dealings in Bangladesh have come under the scanner with the power transition there. And it's also coming at a time when we've heard about the U.S. indictment of the Adani Group, accusing it of engineering that over $250 million bribery scheme, charges that the group has denied. So it's all really piling up and causing a lot of headache for this big conglomerate.
Really interesting. As you say, all of this, of course, against those indictments against the Adani Group in the United States. And for the first time since those, we heard from Gautam Adani, Mr. Adani, the head of the group, at the weekend for the first time. Here's a little bit of what he had to say on the company's website.
Less than 2 weeks back, we faced a set of allegations from the US about compliance practices at Adani Green Energy. This is not the first time we have faced such challenges. What I can tell you is that every attack makes us stronger.
Gautam Adani, pretty defiant in that speech, Arunde, wasn't he?
Absolutely, and he's been like this every time we've seen these kind of allegations come forth repeatedly in the past 2 years. Now, what you heard there was Gautam Adani speaking at a Gems and Jewellery Award ceremony in his home state of Gujarat. So this was the first time that we heard Gautam Adani speak himself beyond the statement that his company has issued where they denied all these charges. Now, this has been a belligerent Gautam Adani ever since, you know, even the Hindenburg report, Will, you would remember, that came out 2 years ago, which had accused the Adani Group of fraud as well as market manipulation charges, again, that the Adani Group had denied. He's always said that no one has been charged with any violation, either before or even with this. This is essentially, in his words, he's always maintained that this is a conspiracy against the Adani Group. And what's most interesting is that he, in a sense, communicated that all these allegations were targeting Gautam Adani, and it was a conspiracy against India. So essentially equating his company with India's growth story, as well as this emerging economy compared to, you know, Gautam Adani, this emerging big industrialist making a name for himself. That's really been his entire defense strategy.
Our senior India business reporter there, Arunade Mukherjee. Let's take you to Ghana now, because the country is going to the polls on Saturday. It's first election since a devastating economic crisis that we've talked about a lot on the programme crashed the currency and led to that IMF bailout. Do skim back through the World Business Report podcast to get the ins and outs of all of that. But our colleague Ed Butler has been in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, to hear how voters, businesses and fishermen are feeling about their economic prospects, and discovered a pretty mixed picture.
I'm standing outside the Accra shopping mall, which is one of the big malls here in the capital city. And, well, whilst inside you've got many of the designer brands, outside you've got a kind of poor person's equivalent. It's a series of kiosks selling shoes, sunglasses, plastic products. And nobody here seems particularly upbeat about the state of the economy at the moment.
My name is Zako Khalid. Business there is slowly.
It's bad.
Yeah. Money no day flow. They say they build a hospital, they never built. They say they build the schools, they never built. It's bad.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Faiza. I don't have enough to eat. I eat only once.
You only eat one meal a day?
I eat once a day because of the economy. So I have to save it, so that tomorrow I can eat it.
Do you have children?
Yes, I have children, two boys.
Two boys.
I'm trying to give them food to eat. I have to make hard work before I get food and give it to them.
What do you do here? What do you sell?
I'm selling apples.
Apples. Yeah. I see apples and fruit and grapes.
Yes. All your fruit is packed up there in a pile. I can't see many people coming to buy. Are there people buying?
The price is high.
The price is high.
So they come one.
How much has the price gone up?
This year. About less than 5 times.
Five times?
This year they increase. Every 2 weeks they increase. The economy is not good. It's not good.
I'm now out on a place called Jamestown Beach. It's right in the middle of Accra, and it's the big port here. In front of me are hundreds, literally hundreds, of tiny fishing boats. This is a huge community here of fishermen, thousands of them, who go out each day and collect their catch to sell in the markets here. But times are tough because of China, the Chinese trawlers that now dominate the fishing grounds, and it's affecting the fishermen's business.
We've been here about so many years. The China people, they bring the water because they have the big trawlers in the sea.
The big Chinese fishing boats are taking all the fish.
Trawlers,
yes.
These people go, they don't get anything.
So it's hard to make a living as a fisherman. It's difficult to get by.
Now, if you don't have money, you can never go fishing. Some people, they are sleeping 1 week. 1 week for the top sea.
Out in their boats, they're sleeping out at sea.
Sleep, 1 week. Sometimes they come, nothing.
Do you want to see the government change the law against the Chinese or what?
The government and China people are the one.
The government and China are one and the same.
They are the one.
A pretty downbeat assessment of the government there in terms of its seemingly cozy relations with one of its main foreign partners. But not everyone in Accra is feeling quite so negative at the moment.
This is an automated roasting machine.
I've come now to Aquaba. It's a small startup processing facility in what feels like a relentlessly entrepreneurial capital city.
So the nuts are going into this big metal box into which you pour your raw cashews.
Yeah.
And what's happening inside?
So it's just roasting. It's from the funnel to the end of the belt. It's a maximum of 14 to 15.
The company's founder and CEO here, Mildred Akutier, is demonstrating to me the scale at which she's now packaging cashew nuts and other products for both domestic and international consumption. For Mildred, the feeling right now is that there's no shortage of opportunity in Ghana.
It is huge and it's growing on a yearly basis, yes. Currently, we can't even meet demand because demand outstrips supply. We can't get enough kernels to roast. This year, for instance, we've had a very poor crop year, but otherwise it's a very profitable industry.
Ghanaians are developing a taste for cashews because it's not a traditional Ghanaian crop, is it?
It is not a traditional Ghanaian crop. It's been farmed for years. However, it's like the plantations are set up to produce raw materials for the West, actually. So it's not a typical traditional meal for Ghanaians, but it is fast becoming, you know, a staple in Ghana for its nutrition and for its culinary uses. And then people are gravitating towards plant-based meals. And these are some of the reasons why it's catching on very fast with Ghanaians.
That's Mildred Akutier there, ending that sample of how voters and small businesses in Ghana feel about their economic prospects as the country prepares to go to the polls. Fascinating election, isn't it? Some of the economic pledges on both sides, from digitisation to a 24-hour economy. There's going to be plenty more of that throughout the week. And if you want to get a bit more of a flavour of Ed's reporting, we're going to have more on the programme tomorrow, but much longer of Ed's report on the Business Daily podcast, wherever you choose to get yours from. Let's round out today, though, talking about a new striking of gold, a discovery in the Chinese province of Hunan. And according to local authorities, it could be the largest in the world, believed to store reserves of more than 1,000 tonnes at a depth of 2,000 metres. And at current gold prices, it'd be worth more than $60 billion. Rona O'Connell is the head of market analysis at the trading platform StoneX. Rona, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
It's a pleasure, Will.
So what do we know about this find?
We know that it's deep. Obviously, you've just said so. 1,000 tons is substantial, but probably The significance of the debts is that in terms of lead times, generally speaking, if you've determined a level of reserve in a mine deposit, it will take up to 10 years before that metal actually starts coming out of the ground. So it's an exciting announcement, but it's not going to have any immediate impact. When it does, it will only actually be raising world mine production by something of the order of 3%. Because if they've got 1,000 tonnes, they're probably not going to want to produce more than 100 a year because they want to have as long a mine life they can, yes.
Yeah. So is the depth potentially why it's not been struck upon before?
Very probably. 2 miles is a long way down. the deepest ones in South Africa are about 3 kilometres.
Right. And so presumably it's going to be very expensive to get it outright at that depth as well.
It will. But I suspect the Chinese government will find the funds from somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. What about that wider impact on the price then? You think not in the short term, but what about down the track?
Not really, no. If we were talking maybe about something like copper, then it could well. But the gold market is very, very deep. And just to give you a couple of numbers, put it into context, mine production globally is about 3,600 tonnes. And if you look at the over-the-counter, i.e. not futures markets, but if you look at the over-the-counter spot market, and then the London Bullion Market Association in the 12 months to the end of October, their spot turnover was 209,000 tonnes, so that's about 58 times world production. And then when you gross that up and add in all the derivatives and so on and so forth, and take account of the fact that the LBMA does not have a monopoly on trading volumes, then turnover is about 100 times mine supply in any one year.
Fascinating nonetheless, though, isn't it? Interesting one. In the run-up to Christmas, a striking of gold. Feels like an exciting thing to have anyway. Rona, thanks so much for your time and your analysis of that. Rona O'Connell there, the head of market analysis at the trading platform Cernex, bring us just about the end of this edition of World Business Report.